Welcome to the Beekeeper's Corner Podcast. January 17th, 2015, episode number 72. Give me a break. Give me a break. Give me a break. Well, you don't have to go into the rest of it. I just wanted to use the give me a break thing. Hi, everybody. Welcome to our first edition of the year. We're already most of the way into January 2015. Can you imagine that? Yep, this is Kevin Englund, and I'm pleased to be back after a well-appreciated holiday break. It was a quiet time for the podcast, but a lot of beekeeping activities were in play during the downtime, and you'll get to hear a bit of what has been going on. The title of Give Me a Break alludes to the pleasure of looking forward to the time off I just had and recharging mentally. I'm starting to get that New Year buzz. Think new car smell, and you'll understand the proper context of that statement, because no, I didn't go out and get buzzed on New Year. I could see the new beekeeping year right in front of me. I could taste it and touch it. I'm talking to friends and colleagues in the beekeeping circles. The excitement of the oncoming year is palpable, and business, as they say, is picking up. I'm getting more and more emails, and I have more and more frequent chit-chat conversations about getting things ready for the early beekeeping season kickoff window of March, which is when New Jersey really starts to get serious with weather and giving us some opportunity to work our bees. And I'm focused on making sure that the tasks that I want to accomplish are completed in time so we don't miss having our equipment in place to meet our 2015 objectives. To me, this is so exciting. And one of the things I've realized year on year is that I've been getting started too late and missing some opportunities. If you've listened to the podcast in the past, and I know I'm in the intro, but bear with me, folks. March 15th is the time when you're really going to start seeing those bees get ready for that first flush of pollen and nectar that's available in New Jersey. We've come to that conclusion. In the past, we always thought it was April or even late April, May. It's March, folks. So now is the time to make sure you're prepared to go out of the gate March 1st in case the weather is warm. All right, I said so exciting. Speaking of exciting, maybe it's time to get in what's in store for this episode. Yeah, that's a pretty ham-handed segue to the agenda. But nonetheless, here we go. For our feature of the episode, I was able to record a short one-on-one with John Gott on the topic of insulating hives for winter. I think you're going to find it pretty compelling and informative, and has changed some of my ideas. For segment number two, I wanted to touch on something on my mind about where life is leading us, a little editorial, if you will. Only two segments this go around, but we're not shortcutting you. In the roundtable section, we'll talk about a fondant recipe that you might want to try at home, courtesy of Bob Kloss, making some jigs for your winter box building projects, a honey cookie recipe, and some other odds and ends to fill out the feature. I guess that's enough of that. Agenda-wise, let's drive into the local hive report so we can get on with the show. Over the holiday break, Christmas time, New Year's, even this past week or so, I have not been out at the hives. I've kind of walked out once or twice, looked. It's been really cold. We had a short break just before the holidays where it was warm. They were flying quite a bit. Went out and took a look at the hives. And the bad news is 9 hives on the property has shrunk to 8. And I suspect that one of the other hives, the one that is in the cedar hive, is not doing very well. And unfortunately, and I know I have a lot of people following me on this, the top bar hive does not look very good. It wasn't the strongest going into winter, and it looks rather retracted, and I'm curious as to whether a small cluster in there is hanging on or if they're going, I can't really tell, and I'm not going to open them up to jeopardize that. So the other hives appear to be hanging on. We had one warm day where it was about 55 degrees, and every hive was flying, including the top bar. But what I couldn't tell at the time of the afternoon that I went out was, were bees going in the top bar to get to any resources and coming out with them? And that wasn't an actual hive. I wasn't, again, going to open it up. The cedar hive had action going at the front, but I feel how light it is, and I don't think it was from their bees. But again, it is what it is. I'm okay in my skin to let them go. And when we get warm days, I'll look and see. I'm not going to try and pull any rescue maneuvers for these hives. They're either going to make it or they're not. The one thing I will say is, as I fed all the hives, because we had no fall flow to speak of, I did not feed the one hive that was nothing but mediums. It was relatively heavy and had a reasonable amount of bees, and I wanted to let that one go on its own. Everything else I fed, and it still feels relatively hefty weight-wise, so I think they're doing okay in there. But that hive, I let it go on its own, and it perished. So I don't find this comical. I find it really frustrating. But it just goes to proof that if you let them be, sorry, I shouldn't use that terminology, if you leave them to their own devices when they have a bad year, they're just not going to make it. They didn't have enough resources, is my guess. So anyway, I'm hanging on for the eight that are there. If I come out with five or six, I am still going to be in really good shape. I plan to split coming into spring. I do know one thing. The honey stores on the cabinet, as I've mentioned, are getting thin. And I do want to make sure that I have some hives for honey this year. So you'll hear me talk about fondant recipe, or Bob Kloss talk about it, and I'm going to make some. So I know one thing, if we get into January or February and the hives are a little questionable, I'm going to throw some fondant on there, but I'm not going to go crazy right now describing that. So local hive report, at least one hive down. The rest of them are all still out there. Hopefully the two weaker ones, which were the top bar and the cedar hive, are hanging on, but we won't know till warmer weather breaks. I know I said I wasn't going to do this, but let me just take this one thing. In the past, what I've said is that if you have hives in that condition, you're going to do them no harm if they're going to expire by breaking them open and feeding them or trying to do some sort of rescue maneuver. In this case, I'm trying to do some sort of sustainability. So if they're not going to make it, then they weren't meant to make it. You're also not going to make a hero hive out of a hive that didn't have spectacular resources to go into winter. You just can't get there. So I don't know. I have mixed feelings. When it gets warmer, if the hive has dwindled but is possibly savable, I might change my mind. But at this point, at least through January, they're on their own. So that's the local hive report. Don't send me hate mail if you don't appreciate that opinion. It just is what it is, and leave it at that, okay? All right, let's go to segment number one.
For segment number one, we're going to call this one, That's a Wrap. We're going to host a short talk with beekeeper John Gott. John is a beekeeper from Mahwah, New Jersey, and an officer with the Northeast branch of the New Jersey Beekeepers Association. John, welcome to Beekeeper's Corner.
Hi, Kevin. Very happy to be here.
I asked you to come join me on the program because I saw a post in the Northeast Facebook page about a presentation you gave regarding insulating hives for the winter. You know, normally a lot of the insights go about how to do it, but you had some ideas about why you do it, and I was really intrigued to talk to you about that. You outlined the data and the benefit for insulating the hive, and we're going to talk about that for a couple of minutes here, but first, give a real brief introduction of you, and I want you to spend a moment and tell us about yourself and your beekeeping operation.
Sure. I actually started keeping bees when I was 9 years old. My father purchased a hive of bees for he and I to work with. This was on a dairy farm. I grew up on a dairy farm. he really didn't have much time for beekeeping. So I ended up keeping the bees. In high school, I had 12 to 14 hives, typically. Extracted the honey, sold the honey on the dairy farm. We also sold the milk. My father made up some labels. We called it the land of milk and honey. When I went away to college, went to school at Penn State in agricultural engineering. My younger brother took over the colonies, and I didn't really keep track of the bees for quite a few years. But then I started hearing about the issues the bees were having, and I thought to myself, well, I know how to keep bees. I can help this problem. I very quickly found out that beekeeping is much more of a challenge today than it was whenever I was in high school. But actually, I like that challenge, and been fairly successful with the colonies for the last 3 years. I started with three colonies. They got through the winter of 2012 and 2013. Last year, I took eight colonies into the winter. Eight colonies came out. And this year, I've got 18 colonies going into the winter, and so far, so good. I hope I'm not jinxing myself.
Yeah, let's hope not. It's become a lot harder, hasn't it?
It sure has. You have to know a lot more about the bees, the more about the colony, so that you can help them do what they do best.
Yeah, so let's talk a bit about why people don't bother to insulate. In your presentation, you went through the reasons why people feel it's not necessary, and I thought you brought out some really good points there.
Okay. When I was keeping bees on a farm, I really didn't insulate per se. We stacked some hay bales against the back of the hives, and the location they were in, actually the snow drifted around the hives quite a bit, so they kind of got some natural insulation. When I started keeping bees here in northern New Jersey, the winters are a little colder than they were in my area of Pennsylvania, so I thought about the potential of having to insulate. And so I heard a lot of reasons not to insulate. So I'll go through those reasons that people gave me and actually what I've found, at least for myself. One of the reasons was that, well, bees don't, you don't really need to insulate the hives. The bees can make it through the winter without the insulation. And that's certainly true. The colony can survive. There needs to be enough bees. There needs to be a large enough colony. There needs to be enough honey and pollen. The other thing is, though, that they need to be able to move to the honey. I talked with a lot of beekeepers that they say their bees starved and the honey was an inch or two away from them, and they just couldn't move to the honey. So I think the insulation helps keep the hive a little bit warmer, at least so that they can move to that honey. The hive also needs to have adequate ventilation. It doesn't need a lot of ventilation. I have a reduced bottom entrance and a small top entrance, and that's adequate ventilation for the colony. Another reason I was given was some of the beekeepers thought the bees get too hot. I really see that the colony, this is one of the fascinating things about the colony, the superorganism. It does a fantastic job of thermoregulation in the hive. The data that I've collected shows me that the hive does not overheat when it's insulated.
Overheat in the context of...
I'm sorry, Kevin.
Yeah, I just wanted to stop and ask you a quick question about that is, it stands to reason that they're going to generate heat in order to keep and maintain the temperature. If it's warmer inside of the hive, even though there's ambient temperature around them, but the temperature is not as cold, they don't have to expend as much energy, but they're not in there running on blast furnace to keep it warm. So to that point, it makes sense. The thermoregulation is a valid point there.
Right. And make another point a little bit later on about whenever the hive environment, again, they're not heating up the hive environment, but because it's insulated, the hive does retain a little bit more heat. Cluster actually can expand a little bit more, and that allows for a little more room for the brood as well.
Interesting point.
The third thing I heard was that some beekeepers were saying the insulation makes the inside of the hive too moist. Every beekeeper says cold doesn't kill the bees, the moisture does. And that's true. The liquid moisture or condensation does kill the bees. I see bees with their heads dying in the frame comb, and you know, that's, some say that's an indication of starving. I'm wondering if some of that is just that the bees just didn't get too cold while they were in those cells. Those bees are in there trying to heat up the comb and the cluster, mm-hmm. And that they might have gotten too cold because they've gotten wet with moisture. I've seen comb that has moldy, especially if it's on the outside of the hive. And again, I think what's happened is the condensation's come down and gotten that comb wet, and that's allowed the mold to start growing then once the hive did warm up. So you need adequate ventilation to remove that moisture while it's still a vapor. If that vapor hits a cold surface, whether it's the side of the hive or the top inner cover, it's going to condense right away. You need to keep those surfaces warm enough to prevent that condensation so that moisture can go out as a vapor.
When you're insulating your hive, are you tucking the insulation right up against the outer board, or are you leaving a gap?
It's right against the outside of the hive, and it's right on top of the inner cover.
Okay. I was thinking about, they say that wood breathes, right? Even if it's painted, it'll still exude some moisture, and I'm wondering if leaving a little air gap would help facilitate, but most of it's going to go out of the top. Heat rises, whatever heat they generate, it's going to go out of the top ventilation.
Yeah, and I really haven't seen any issue with, let me say, moisture trap between the insulation and the sides of the hives. The insulation I have is not fancy. The rainwater, melted snow, it actually can get down in between the sides of the hive and the insulation some places. So you see evidence of that, but it runs out and it's fine. The hive bodies themselves don't show any evidence of being too moist at all.
Interesting. So how about the benefits of doing this? So we talked about some of the reasons people feel that there isn't a need, but there's definitely reasons to do that. And you've been doing monitoring of your hives from a temperature standpoint, survivability, things like that.
Right. So in one of the hives, I put a data logger inside the hive that records the temperature and the humidity inside the hive, and I also put a data logger on the outside. And on the presentation that I posted on the Facebook page, there was a couple graphs there. One graph showed beginning of last January was a relatively cold period for us here. It went to below 0 degrees 2 days in a row, January 4th and January 5th. So the data logger on the outside of the hive captured that. But the data logger on the inside of the hive showed the inside of the hive just staying a nice 50 degrees Fahrenheit the whole time. Again, this isn't where the cluster is. This is at the top of the hive above the cluster. Mm-hmm. But again, indicating that with that insulation, it mitigated a lot of that cold from the outside. It was also a little bit windy then. The insulation also acts as a wind barrier and prevents the air infiltration then too. The data logger also, I was concerned about maybe the inside of the hives getting too moist when I first started insulating, but the humidity monitoring shows that the relative humidity stays well below 100%, well below where anything would condensate on the hive, become water moisture. The inside of the hive does stay nice and warm. The relative humidity will vary depending if there's bees around the data logger or not, but it stays anywhere between, I'll say, 50% and 70%. I've seen it get as high as 80, but again, the water's not going to condense until it gets to 100% relative humidity. So the data that I've been collecting, and I'm collecting more this winter as well. I'm monitoring two hives this year, and I've got some thermocouples buried deeper in the hives to get some more of that data as well. But I'm seeing the same thing this year as I saw last year so far. So overall, the benefits of insulating the hive, I see it reducing the heat loss and also reducing the air infiltration into the hive. That's especially true on those cold, windy nights. I think those cold, windy nights is whenever the colonies die. Yeah. They get too cold. Mm-hmm. The insulation does allow the bees to move to the honey more than an uninsulated hive. Bees won't move if it's less than 42 degrees. They won't walk on a surface if it's less than 45 degrees. But having that insulation there retains some of the heat that cluster is giving up. Again, the bees aren't really insulating that or aren't heating that space, but the insulation does help retain a little bit of it. And again, I've got the ventilation so that there's adequate ventilation, but it's not a chimney or a windstorm going through the hive. By the way, I have screen bottom boards, but I close them off completely.
Okay.
One of the concerns was that the colony would consume more honey because they'd be warmer, they'd be more active. I can weigh my hives pretty quickly, and I typically weigh them once a week, and I really did not see them using any more honey. As a matter of fact, they hardly used any through December and January, but then in February, March, they started consuming more as they start making more and more brood.
Making brood, yeah. It's the time of the year for them to start going, right?
One of the pieces of information I picked out of Noah Wilson Rich's book, Natural History of Bees, was that for every 11 degrees Fahrenheit reduction in temperature, the bees must work twice as hard to keep it warm to function. If it's a 22 degrees difference, it's four times as hard. So those bees that are heating the hive, I think, have got to work very, very hard on those cold nights. And, they're using the same muscles as they use for flight. I'm wondering if it those bees don't live as long if they're working that lifespan, hard for thermoregulation.
Yeah, good points. So in your setup, two questions. The first one is, are you monitoring hives that are insulated and hives that are not? Just so you have a control. And the other question.
I do not have a control. This year I thought about having a control and not insulating a colony, but over the last previous two winters, I didn't feel comfortable not insulating a colony. We talk about losses in the winter and, 30%, 20%. I kind of look at all losses are preventable, and that's probably a pretty strong stance, right? Almost mission impossible.
But, yeah.
I really work on trying not to have any losses, and it's not just insulation that does that. There's other things I've got to do too, of course, but I just could not bring myself to have a control that wasn't insulated.
You have to find a neighbor, John, that doesn't insulate and sticks
up. Well, there are plenty of other people that don't insulate, and those are kind of the controls, I guess.
Yeah, that's true. So how is your hive monitoring system work? How do you have it hooked up?
Well, it's just a data logger that's in the hive. It's a standalone data logger that is battery operated, and it just collects temperature and humidity once every 30 minutes. And periodically, I take it out and download the data and put it back in to collect more data. And it's the same thing on the outside of the hive as a data logger. So it's not terribly sophisticated,
but it gets the job done. And your wrapping of the hives, of course, people are going to want to know what the cost is. The cost of bees and losing a colony probably justifies the cost of insulating a hive. So what's a ballpark for insulating a hive?
A good a good number is really $25 a hive. I'm using extruded polystyrene, 2 inches thick, and off of a 4x8 sheet of polystyrene, I can insulate 2 hives and a little bit more. So that 2 inch thick polystyrene has an R value of 10. That's, you know, 13 times more insulation than just the hive body itself.
Sure.
Actually, I have one colony that thinks that they're in the middle of a 4 foot diameter tree. I'm not able to convince them otherwise. they think they've got, you know, a lot of wood above them. They think they've got 10 inches of wood around them all on all the four sides. And they've got a little opening that they come in out of during the sunny days. So I got tired of arguing with them. They just think they're nice and cozy in there.
Before you came on, we were talking about the importance, if you're not going to wrap your hives or you're not going to insulate your hives, to at least put insulation across the top.
Correct. Yeah, if you're in the South, if you're in the Florida, Mississippi, and so forth, you probably don't need to do this. But a lot of the beekeepers in Vermont, Canada, do put insulation between the inner cover and the outer cover. And I think that has a tremendous benefit. The biggest benefit is it prevents that condensation from occurring on the inner cover and then raining down on the bees. So that's really easy to do, and it's very inexpensive. And even somebody that hasn't done it up to this point in winter, I think it's still worthwhile to go ahead and do.
And people are using different techniques for some of that moisture control too. If they have concerns, they're using quilt boards or using moisture traps, the build right boards, things like that on the top of the hive underneath the insulation to trap any moisture that does get contained.
Yeah, for the way I have it set up, I don't need to trap that moisture. As a matter of fact, I wonder if trapping that moisture may be doing the wrong thing. If the moisture actually does get trapped in a quilt board or a moisture board, it loses its insulating value and just causes more and more condensation. It could cause more condensation. The other thing is that, you know, the top of the hive is going to be warm and moist because all the moisture from the cluster is coming there. And I'm afraid that it could cause some microbiological growth of some nasty things that might actually cause chalk brood or stone brood in the colony as well.
Interesting point. So take us through how you literally attach the insulation to the hive and what your top looks like and things like that. How do you do it?
Again, I use 2-inch extruded polystyrene. This is either blue board or pink board. Blue board from Lowe's, pink board from Home Depot, for example. But off a 4x8 sheet, I can get enough insulation to insulate 2 hives. I cut the insulation to be as wide as the wider side of the hive body, about 19¾ inch wide. And I cut all the strips that width. That way, on across the front, which is a little bit narrower, it does overlap 2 inches on the sides then. And again, 2 inches of insulation on the top. I have a 3½-inch shim that I put on top of the inner cover, and then put the insulation inside that shim. And I can actually turn that or pick up the insulation a little bit and put pollen patty or fondant in between the inner cover and that insulation if I want to. Normally, I just put it underneath that inner cover, though.
And how do you physically secure them to the hive, John?
I just use bungee cords. I have two 48-inch bungee straps going around. And so that's really all that is holding them in place. I'm able to put all four pieces of insulation on the hive and wrap the bungee straps around them very quickly. But I got to tell you, it's taken a little practice getting everything just set right. It usually goes much quicker with two people doing it the first time.
Yeah, I could imagine it's a challenge. We could use some of those lash strips, the nylon ones, if you know which ones I mean.
The ratchet straps, you mean?
Yes.
Yeah, I actually use the ratchet straps around the top of the hive to hold the lid on. So, yeah, that does help. You kind of get the two side pieces between the ratchet straps and then just help with the bungee cords around the front and the back.
Yeah, so, John, we're recording on computer and my email keeps blinging and doing whatever, so forgive the distractions if you're hearing them. This has been just great. You had a presentation which we can share. We'll put a link to it in our show notes. And anything else that I didn't think to ask you?
No, I think, again, I appreciate being able to come on and talk about insulating hives. Again, I think that if people consider doing this, their chances of getting colonies through the winter would improve. It's not the only thing they need to do, of course. In the presentation, I talk about some of the other things. And in the presentation, why there's some pictures showing the details of the insulation and so forth that maybe does a better job of showing how it's done than I'm able to describe. But again, I really appreciate being able to come on. Thanks for having me. And Kevin, the other thing I've got to say is thanks very much for doing the Beekeeping Corner podcasts. I do listen to them regularly, and I do think that they're very informative and do help a lot of people. So thanks very much for that.
Yeah, thanks for that. You know, I wanted to ask you one other thing before I let you go, which was the difference between insulation with this foam and wrapping a hive with tar paper. They're not the same.
No, the wrapping the hive with the tar paper does, I think, help with the wind infiltration, especially on some older equipment. Again, this is the engineer in me, but the concept of the sun heating the hive more with the black tar paper than it would otherwise, I think that's true to a certain extent. But the other part is that at night, that a dark surface radiates heat out to space quicker than a white surface. And it's just physics. So, net, I don't think that the dark tar paper really does what as much good as people think. You know, people think that the hive warms up a little quicker and the bees come out flying quicker during a warm day. With the insulated hive, I see the bees flying on warm days just like another hive that may not be insulated. As a matter of fact, I think with an insulated hive, they might actually come out a little quicker because they're already a little warmer. The cluster's already a little more spread out, so they can get a little bit of a jump on everybody else coming out.
Interesting. You know, I don't insulate my hives. I never actually thought it was necessary, but your presentation actually made me think twice about that. I do say that I have one polystyrene hive out in the yard, so maybe that one will convince me that this is the right track to go.
Yeah, that's probably a good control. The other people that have polystyrene hives have actually seen some of the benefits of having that insulation there during the winter and also somewhat during the summer as well.
Yeah, my polystyrene hive, it was the only one I didn't have an entrance guard for in the late fall, and I think it got robbed late, and I really had to feed the thing, and I'm not sure how great it was going into winter, but thus far, I've lost one hive so far, but going out and looking at what's going on, that hive still seems pretty functional.
Good. Yeah, maybe one other comment. I mean, part of my motivation for insulating the hives, too, is to try to give the bees a little better start in the spring. The honey flow around this area, anyway, is very early. Really kind of starts in April and May, and then it drops off pretty quickly after that. So You know, part of my motivation is trying to give those colonies every benefit of having a good start in the spring. I think insulating helps them get more brood going in the early part of the spring, and they're able to take the advantage of those nectar flows that are early.
I know in your presentation you cited, I think, something out of Minnesota. Is that right?
Correct. Yeah, that I really researching insulating hives. I wasn't able to find a lot, studied by the Agricultural Engineering Department at the University of Wisconsin. I think they put like 2,000 thermocouples in 15 hives and did a study over 5 years. And so, you know, they did. That was some very good information there about how an uninsulated hive does compared to an insulated hive. They also had a set of hives that were heated with up to 40 degrees. And the hives that were heated didn't seem to have any real difference from those that were insulated. I know some people actually do heat their hives a little bit. At least that study showed that insulating the hives has the same effect as heating the hives. And, you know, the colonies, the insulated colonies started to brood rearing earlier than the uninsulated hives. They found that the uninsulated hives did catch up after the weather, warm weather arrives. But again, for this area, you know, by the time the warm weather arrives, a lot of the nectar flow was we're well into the nectar flow anyway.
And that was the point I was going to bring, is I think your point is really valid. And I've covered that study in the past. I think it was a long time ago. And I recall the study saying that non-insulated hives catch up quickly. And I always thought, well, why would you bother then if they catch up? In fact, I think that study showed that they actually passed insulated hives at one point, but that might be false memory on my part. But you have it dead on. March 15th, your hives need to go here in New Jersey where we are. If you're not set with your hives brooding up and going to a swarm state or full on, you're going to miss the advantages of the nectar flow. So early starts, I think you're spot on. As early as you can get them going, the better you'll be here in the Northeast.
That's what I'm thinking. But also, you know, I think the insulated, you know, the colonies die on those cold, windy February nights. And I think that the insulation helps prevent the let's say the weaker colonies anyway from dying. You know, the insulation retains some of the heat that the interior hive doesn't get on quite as much, and so it helps the colonies make it through the winter. Some that would normally die, I think, make it through because insulation.
Well, you've piqued my interest, and I'm sure our listeners are going to find this very interesting. You can go take a look at the presentation, and, you know, maybe what we'll do is we'll look at our mentoring hives this year and look to see if we can do some experimentation of monitoring them or something. I'll have to talk to the association, as we have a number of hives owned by the club that we could monitor. Yeah, I think you're going to get me on track of insulating my hives next year. Survivability and sustainability. It's just something, I'm sick of investing all my energy into something that is, as you said, difficult. From the beginning, it's difficult to keep these hives alive. Whatever we could do to make it more successful for everybody, that's really the key.
Absolutely.
Well, John, this has been great. I appreciate you taking the time. We kind of got through this impromptu, and I know you're heading out to the ABF conference in California.
Yep.
And looking forward to that. I wish I could have come, but unfortunately, I'm heading back to work tomorrow.
Yeah, I'm lucky to be able to go this year, so I'll take advantage of it.
Well, good for you, and maybe when you get back, you could circle back with us and tell us, hit the highlights, be our roving reporter, so to speak.
Okay, yeah, I think there's a few people going out from New Jersey, but not a lot, of course, since it's in California, so.
Yeah, I know Stan and Fran will be there if you've listened to my last episode, so. Well, John, let's wrap it up. Thanks again for coming on. I really appreciate it. Have a good flight. Enjoy the show out there, and keep in touch.
Okay. Thanks, Kevin. Take care.
Take care.
For segment number two, I call this one I Want It All. Every once in a while, I do some soul searching and reaffirm the direction of the podcast and where it's going. As I am in the process of my annual reviews at work, it can't help but spill over when I start thinking about the podcast and where this effort fits into the big picture. I still like the podcast point of view and where it compares to other podcasts and outlets and what they provide. There's a lot of good information out there, as I've said in the past, on blogs and YouTube channels and other, but the podcast seems to have its own little space in the world. I thought it would be interesting to talk about the dynamic of information consumption and trust. I must admit that when I started this, I did it in the context of kind of a blog or journal on beekeeping activities. If you go back and listen to the primer, you know what my objectives were. I tend to journal and document things in my life, nothing to do with beekeeping, and I suppose it's just in my nature. Everywhere I go, I make little notes. I collect tickets for events that I go to. Someday I'll scrapbook them. It sounds kind of weird, but I take pictures and I even shoot video. Over the holidays, we went to New York City and I documented everything that we did. And I do periodically go back and relive some of these things that I've done in the past, and I enjoy it. I also think it's a neat history, especially when my family participates, that we can go back and relive it and my kids will have it. Along the way, it became evident to me that enough people were following this effort, and it expanded and matured my point of view on the approach. I spend more time than I would have imagined preparing content and fact-checking things. I guess it's part of my type A personality, part of it's for my sanity purpose, because if I could provide evidence of what is presented, I won't be ridiculed in the public forum, which is something I dread. I just don't want to deal with that. And it would be something that would ruin the experience and make me go away. So I'm okay with criticism and feedback and whatever. But when people start to get, really goofy about this thing, it turns me off. And I do this for pleasure and now for a sense of contributing to beekeeping, something I believe in. And there's still enough of a personal journal aspect to it, and it has served me well. So like I said, I like the point of view. I can go back through my catalog and episodes and see what I've done and what I've learned. And I feel fortunate for the body of work, as that adage that someone has forgotten more than one knows is not true for me. I just have to pull up an episode, so that's really cool. I want it all. I want it all, and I want it now, as Queen would tell you. I didn't want to make this about me, but I had to start there to get where I'm going. So recently I was reflecting on my habits and how the world has changed. And perhaps this is too far back, but it goes to illustrate a point that I'll refer back to the 90s, a time when the internet was taking shape and the notion of access to information started to become relevant. Prior to the 90s, if you wanted information, you got a book, or you looked upon the circle of influence of your friends, people you knew, whatever your sphere of influence was, that was your world. Today, we have communities of subject matter experts that are a keyboard away. Times have changed, and the world as we know it has changed. I think to my children in the way of life that they will lead. Shopping, education, healthcare, life events, all have changed due to the ubiquitous access of information. We were talking just yesterday about how when we were kids, we used to open up the Sears catalog and look what was coming when we dreamed about Christmas. Now we go to Amazon.com. Bringing this back to beekeeping, we have similar avenues. I would venture to guess that the average age of our beekeepers is not conducive with being computer and mobile savvy, but I know that audience is out there too. When I personally questioned our association members from our beekeepers group how many use Facebook and the internet, the response was surprisingly low. I would say less than 50%, and I would guess it was probably more like 30%. I must be an anomaly for my age. So what you have in this world is we have the haves and the have-nots. And as an officer of a beekeeping association and a person who does a podcast, which is immersed in technology, I have to keep in mind that many of our members are not likely to follow articles that we share via Facebook or watch YouTube or do any of that. And it provides the Beekeepers Association with an onus to keep the one-on-one interactions rich and meaningful as possible, and we can't lose sight of that. That's why one of the primary aspects of our association is to make sure that a good percentage of our activities are hands-on. You can't skip that stuff. So that being said, what about the percentage that are in technology and also about this generation to come? How do you serve them? I want to relay a notion that captures the essence of how they think. I'm going to make this up, but anyone who has a tween or teen can probably back me up on this. I'll pretend that I'm taking my family to the Empire State Building, something we did actually two winters ago during the holiday season. Normally, you arrive and you're standing in line, looking up at the building. In 1990, you would be patient, go through the line, snap some photos, and read the posters on the wall. You'd get home. You take your photos to Photomat, and you put them in an album. How quaint. In 2014, when you're cleaning your house, you open and reminisce about those photos and say, I really should scan these things in and make them digital. In our situation, current day, you look up the trip to New York City. You research how long it would take, where you could park, where you could eat nearby, and what to do at the Empire State Building. You'd know the restaurant you're going to go to after for lunch. You know how much tickets are. And you see quite a bit about the experience you're going to show your kids. On the day of, cut to being in line in the building, modern times. You're relaying some of the experience you know about what you're going to see to your kids, but they're already ahead of you. On the train ride, they Google the Empire State. They know how many floors there are, they've seen pictures, they've watched YouTube video from the observation deck, and they could tell you about the backpass tour and how much it costs and what's included in it. It's because they've already fact-checked the building from Wikipedia, and they just mill about texting friends about what's next on the tour, and they go through these stupid, inefficient lines in their mind, waiting for it all to be over. And they go outside, do a quick walk around, amazed for 30 seconds from the observation level. They get a few shots for their Facebook page. They Twitter a selfie of themselves, and they're ready to go home. These are the beekeepers of our future. Their appetite for engagement is on a whole different plane. So why do I make the point about how does this matter? There's a classic line in the movie Spaceballs that asks, when is here now? Colonel Sanders, try here, stop, dark helmet. What the hell am I looking at? When does this happen in the movie? Now, you're looking at now, sir. Everything that happens now is happening now. What happened to then? We passed then. When? Just now. We're at now. Go back to then. When? Now. Now? I can't. Why? We missed it. When? Just now. When will then be now? Soon. How soon? I can't resist these things. Likely you're here today for information, and I would venture to guess that we're not a passing fancy, but many of the resources that you have access to. Going back to the days of yore, the 90s, we used to seek out the same subject matter expert with our friends, families, acquaintances. But right now, today, you could sign up in the BeeSource forum and be immersed in a wealth of knowledge that you would never have access in the past, no matter how big your sphere of influence was. You can log into Amazon and buy books on a broad range of topics of something specific. You could find hundreds of blogs on the topics of beekeeping. Yes, you can even find podcasts. So one thing I hear often is there's just too much information. It's easy to find conflicting information. Feed the bees. Don't feed the bees. Use chemicals when mite thresholds are high. Never treat. It's enough to make your mind explode. I see the world where it's going. I work in technology, mobile technology to be specific, and the world in front of us is going to be incredible. This access to information has made people more informed, savvy, and in some cases, brazen and opinionated. The downside of information is some can get into that prospect that they are smart, but perhaps they are book smart and lack that physical experience. I guess at some point I should have a point by which to conclude this topic. What am I trying to say? I have no idea. How about that? I think we're in a world that is going to transform. And then one has to wonder how to stay relevant and understand how to live in this world. For me, it's about providing accurate and timely information and how to be a trusted resource. I'd like you to have confidence in what I'm saying. I'd like you to understand and appreciate what's available. I can't think of more ways to provide information. I guess I'm kind of in that modern mix. Website, Facebook, YouTube, this podcast thing. But it's greater than that. I'm concerned about our legacy as beekeepers. Beekeeping in the 2000s, how will we be judged? If you want to know how it was done in the 1800s, you pick up The Hive and the Honeybee, and you read the book. In the future, people go back and listen to these recordings. Were we on the right track? That's an interesting question. Or will history judge us and approach our approaches as folly and silly? All these commentary and angst about treatment-free and mite treatments and all these things that happen. We will be a footnote someday. Will someone in the future use my podcast to illustrate how wrong we had it? Or say that this was the foundation that jumped us into the modern way of beekeeping? I have no idea. That's an interesting question, which I guess we'll learn over time. And our future generations will judge us. And maybe they'll listen to this actual recording and think, wow, they were thinking about all that back then. So anyway, it's the beginning of a new year. And I thought I'd just share that I am recognizing the fact that media and the way of the world is changing. We're a part of it, but we kind of have to keep looking at where we're going and make sure we're on the right track. That's it. I'm going to stop there. Thanks for listening. So it's time to head into the roundtable section of the podcast. This is the back of the book. We're going to talk about begonia.com. Now, I don't know if that's the proper way to say it. It's very American to say bugonia, and bug is, I guess, relative, given that we're insect lovers of bees. Begonia is a term for an ancient ritual practiced in Egypt where oxen were buried with their horns protruding above the ground. The ends of the horns were then cut off, with the belief being that the severed horns were the origin of honeybees. It continued for centuries, and for references in treating this practice as fact can be found in naturalist books as late as the 1700s. Okay, what does this all mean? Begonia.com is a research site, and it's open for beekeepers. NAPPC is part of it, the North American Pollinator Protection Campaign, the University of Delaware, Mid-Atlantic Apiculture Research and Extension Consortium, MERIC, Center for Urban Bee Research, Penn State, and Hamilton all have a part of this. So how does it work, you ask? It's an online database where beekeepers can enter data about their hives. It's tagged as research by the beekeeper for the beekeeper. You can then participate after you enter in a variety of research projects, and real-time reports allow you to track your results and even compare your findings with results in your areas. And the results are aggregated across the beekeepers and published in beekeeping journals and peer review journals. So in 2014, a couple projects going on. The first one was beekeepers using nematodes to control hive beetles. The next one, Project 2, was testing the efficacy of integrated pest management programs for controlling Varroa destructor. These are 2014 projects. Presume they'll be back in 2015 for some additional ones. And it's a pretty neat concept. And again, it costs nothing for you to participate. You could check our show notes for the link, but here it is, bugonia.com. That's where you can check it out on the internet.
Our next Beekeepers Association meeting comes up here in February, and one of the topics we're going to have is winter feeding. Bob Kloss, who's been on the podcast and has helped us out quite a bit, has a really good recipe for fondant that he got. It's a derivative from a video that came from DC Honeybees. You can look on YouTube for that. He has an outstanding video. We'll put that in the show notes on how to do this. Bob changed the recipe up a little bit, and I knew he had this formula, and I wanted to make some... Actually, I'm going to make a video over the weekend here of how to make some fondant, and I'm going to make some here at the house. I've always wanted to try it. So at a beekeepers meeting that we had for our association, I pulled Bob aside in the parking lot and asked him if he would be kind enough to share the recipe and some insights. And while we were standing there, it was 12 degrees, he ran through it kindly enough, and I recorded it from my phone. Unedited, this is what we discussed, and you can get a taste of how to make it and some of his insights.
Okay, 4 cups of water in a pan boiling. You put in 1/4 cup of Karo corn syrup. You put in the juice of 1 lemon, which is about a tablespoon. Then you put in 10 pounds of sugar. You cook that, you heat it up until it reaches 240 to 245. I like 245, gives me the right consistency. And then you stop, you let it cool down to between 180 and 200, and that's when you beat it with a mixer. So after it, as it cools down, it still will be translucent. Okay, when you start beating it, it'll start turning whitish. That's as it's crystallizing. You don't want to beat it too long. As soon as you start seeing it turn white, you want to pour it out. Otherwise, and it'll flow like liquid at that point. If you wait till much longer, you'll be scooping it out. Or if you wait too long, it'll turn solid on you.
Okay. And can you get it back after it's solid? Or?
I don't know. I've never gotten that to that point. I've gotten to the point where it's hard to get out of the pan.
Yeah.
But it was good enough.
Okay.
Any
other, what do you pour it into?
What I try to do, and this is why I try, don't let it crystallize too much, I try to make it thin. So I pour it into 3 cookie sheets, on 3 big cookie sheets,
yeah,
because I want to make it thin enough that I don't have to put a spacer on my hive, that I can just put it on the hive the way
tip.
It is.
And do you put it on parchment paper or anything like that?
Yes, I use parchment paper, exactly.
Okay.
Yes, it peels right off when you're done. And then you can break it up. It's a consistency like fudge where you can break it up.
And how long does it take to set up? Does it set up overnight?
Oh, no, it'll set up as soon as it cools.
Okay.
So it won't take that long.
All right, cool. All right, thanks, Bob.
Yep.
So there you have it right from Bob. And I like one of the things that Bob said when we discussed this after the fact is that 245 target range is a softball stage. And that's what gives it that mushy consistency like Play-Doh. I've seen people who've cooked it a little harder, I think, and it becomes really hard and crumbly, almost like a hard candy. And, you know, when you're working with that and you break it, it splinters, it goes all over the place. This is malleable. you can break it off. I've never seen anybody come up with as good a consistency as what Bob had. So that formula for me is the right one, and I'm really interested in. I'm hoping that I can get the same result out of it. I have sugar. I have a stand mixer, and you do want to do this with a stand mixer. I have a KitchenAid stand mixer. My recollection from watching the video and seeing other people and hearing other people discuss this is that a hand mixer is not going to work. You're going to want to have something with a lot of horsepower in order to stir this through. So stay posted. You'll see us post a video up on YouTube of the result at some point. And again, thanks to Bob for sharing his insights. For roundtable number three, I wanted to talk about some jigs. We're doing the jig. Over the holidays, I found a little time to try and get to some projects that I wanted to do in the garage. One of them was using excess wood that I had laying around to build some boxes. I had some small boxes with handholds, but the corners were rotted. I cut them out and made new boxes out of them. And I took old plywood and old panel boards that I had, all 3/4 inch, and made new boxes. I wanted to build a quiet box. I wanted to build some queen castles. I wanted to build some swarm trap boxes and others. So I was using the table saw left and right for days and had my truck parked outside, but I've got that all cleaned up and the truck is in the garage. Because if you didn't know it, garages for vehicles. Yeah, that's just a Kevin moment there. I love all the people who have a garage and it becomes extra storage and their vehicles are parked outside. I'm not quite clear on that concept, so I very much make it a point that my vehicle will never be parked outside for more than a week straight. And Sharon keeps me honest on that too. But anyway, I was talking about jigs. One of the things I don't particularly like is trying to hold two pieces of wood together while I'm trying to fasten them. It doesn't matter whether it's a finger joint box that you buy from the store and you're trying to secure them, or what I was doing, some boxes that were made out of wood pieces that were butt jointed and screwed. You could get yourself in trouble sometimes when the boxes are oblong and they're not 90 degree at the corners. And you also can get in trouble where you screw things and you get a little bit of a twist and the box has this rotating motion when you put it over top of other boxes on the stack. So to that end, I bought a flat piece of board that I know was true. And I bought corner brackets that I happened across at Lowe's, but you can buy them on the internet, Home Depot. Massey makes them. I'm getting ahead of myself. I bought these corner brackets and I screwed them to the board. I had a commercially built box that was square and true, and I used it as the jig to set them permanently on a flat board. So now what I have is a piece of plywood with 4 corner brackets mounted to the base. And I could take my pieces that I'm going to assemble and screw them in and fasten them in these clamps and then put corners up on the top. And I have a flat box and I have all my corners true and I have them locked in where I could just fasten them, nail them, screw them, whatever I'm going to do, glue them, and I'm good to go. I also built a small little handheld jig. This is one that has a little piece of plywood with a 4x4 piece, and it clamps in one of my vices that I have in the garage or in the downstairs workshop. And all it literally does is allow me to clamp two pieces together in a 90 degree using clamps and screw them, and I can be hands-free. So I could literally use the box jig, or I can use the jig to put 90 degrees together. And I built the box with that, all 4 corners, just by keep rotating the box and clamping in the new piece. And it worked out really well. I'll have pictures of these and I'll put them up. And I'll also have a little video of them, and we're going to show these on demo at the next Northwest New Jersey Beekeepers meeting. So one of the other things is I have straight plywood or panels with no handholds. I had seen videos in the past of how to cut a handheld with a circular saw, I wasn't particularly enamored with the sled idea that the people had. It looked kind of kludgy. I didn't like the way that the handhelds were coming out. And it didn't, quite frankly, look rather safe. Eventually, you're going to end up cutting your arm off. So, one thing I did find was a way to do this with a table saw. The way that it works is you build this jig that allows you to butt your end of your piece of wood, whether it's a long or a short side, to a high box, and you lower it down onto the table saw, and you keep lowering it as you move it up and down in the jig, and it eventually cuts a handheld. It takes a little bit of practice. I'll have a video link to somebody whose idea I used to build the jig with, and I've been cutting out my own handhelds. Now, the jig that I built is not perfect because I see the things sometimes you slip and you miss or whatever. But my key thing is I didn't want to cut my fingers off. So I looked at the way this worked and I looked at all the dumb things that could potentially happen. And I built the jig to make sure that it can't slip and my hand would go into the saw or anything like that. So I'm pretty confident in the way that it's built. It's really simple to use. It would probably be easier. I have a singular blade and I do not have a dado set. For the uninclined, a dado set is just a stacked bunch of table saw blades that create a thickness from 1/4 inch to almost 5/8 of an inch if you want it. And in this thing, you could almost like lower the board down and cut the handheld out all in one place. I suggest you go look at the show notes and look at the video. You'll understand what I'm talking about. So I've built a number of boxes. And I've cut my own handhelds out, and I'm really pleased with the result. And the boxes are made out of old scrap wood. It's warped. It's twisted. The boxes aren't perfect. If I had worked with straight, brand new pine stock, they would have been spectacular. Now, one of the things I was thinking about is butt joining, which is where you just take two boards and you push them together and you screw them, is not the strongest thing to do in the world. You're screwing through a face of a board, which is good. Thumbs up, but you're going into the end grain of a board with a screw, which is not good. Eventually, that's not going to work. There were methodologies on the internet to cut splines to join the two with glue, and that would be as strong or as strong of a joint you could get without doing a finger joint. I didn't go that far. Again, what I think these things are going to be is just spare boxes to kick around. They're made out of plywood. They're not going to be durable over course of a million years, like a regular box made out of dry kiln pine that you get from the store. But if I'm going to use them for a couple seasons for a swarm trap or to put some swarms in when I'm going out and getting some calls or whatever, they will more than suffice. One of the other things that I built, I mentioned, is a queen castle. It's basically just a box divided into chambers with different entrances. Very excited to have that. I'm very excited to get into that business. It's not something I have experience with. But I have seen a plethora of swarm queen cells that I think could be harvested. And maybe the objective for 2015 is to make more hives using those. And they are a local stock. So also giving a presentation in February at that meeting on queen castles. And I'll probably record that and be able to put that up on the Northwest site somewhere along. Bob Kloss and I are tag teaming on that, so looking forward to that. So check out our show notes and look for some beehive building jigs, the sleds for using a table saw, and I'll also put the jig up there with the circular saw. You can use that. Your mileage may vary if you're interested in that. You can take a look there too. For round table number 4, I will say H is for honeybee cookies. During the break, Sharon was cleaning out, doing some housekeeping. We have a cupboard underneath the glasses where we keep all our cookbooks. And over the years, we've accumulated cookbooks and recipes and other things in there. And it was time for a hoeing out. That's what H stands for, really. So Sharon was cleaning it out, and she came across this little cookbook called Alpha Bakery Gold Medal Children's Cookbook. It was put out by Gold Medal, the flour company, which I think somehow has a relationship to Betty Crocker, but I'm not sure of the tie there. Whatever the case, it was bought when the kids were younger to try and get them interested into cooking. and to give him some ideas of how recipes worked. It has big, friendly kid pictures with simple recipes and instructions. Well, as I said, H is for honeybee cookies. So we made some. I kind of knew, looking at the ingredients, and I'll run through them real quick, and I'll tell you what the outcome was. So it has a half cup of margarine or butter softened, a half cup of packed brown sugar, a half cup of honey, an egg, 1.5 cups of all-purpose flour. Of course, they want you to use gold medal. A half teaspoon of baking soda, a half teaspoon of salt, and a half teaspoon of ground cinnamon. Pretty simple. I look at these ingredients and I said, well, butter, brown sugar, and honey with flour, if you cook that together, the brown sugar is going to melt a little bit, the butter is going to run. These things are going to flatten out and be thin and crispy on the edges because that's the typical MO. The honey will make them brown. They're going to be thin, crispy-edged cookies. That's what they're going to be. And you know what? They were thin, crispy-edged cookies. You're supposed to put them on a baking sheet. It indicates you did not have to grease the baking sheet, but they stuck like crazy. I don't know if it's just because our baking sheets are like that. I did a double batch of these. So I doubled all the things and mixed it in a mixer. It says they're supposed to cook for 7 to 9 minutes. I had to cook them for 13 to 14. Whatever the case, when they first came out, they were kind of eh. They were like pretty flat tasting, not very tasty, had a funny texture to them. Gave some to Danny, gave some to Brian, gave some to Sharon, and everybody ate them and said, okay, they're cookies. How could I be bad? But they weren't spectacular. But the funny magic happened the next day. It was rather interesting that when you went to eat them the next day, they had a completely and utterly different texture. They were really flavorful. They had a lot more body, if you can understand that description. And they had a great texture to them. They were a little bit softer, but they were firm around the edges. And they weren't... It's really unusual for you to make a cookie, at least my experience, that tastes better the next day than it does when it comes right out of the oven. Because usually when they're warm and they're great, baked goods are so good. But in this case, they got better as time went on. So much so that the double batch that nobody was interested in on the first day were gone when I came home from work. So this is how it works. I told you what was in it. Heat the oven to 375, beat margarine, brown sugar, and honey, plus the eggs in a medium bowl on medium speed until smooth, and then you stir in the remaining ingredients. Drop the dough by teaspoonfuls into an ungreased cookie sheet. I buttered one, and it still stuck, so I'm not sure what the secret is there. Maybe you put them on parchment paper. Bake until set and light brown around the edges, and it says the surface of the cookies will appear shiny, and I agree with that. You could see the edges firming up, and you could see the tops kind of browning over, and it did have a glimmery appearance on the top. You could actually see the sugar crystals shining like sparkles in the snow. You're going to let them stand 3 to 5 minutes, and then you're going to move them off to some sort of wire rack to cool. The recipe, I doubled it, but the ones that I told you about in the proportion of ingredients makes 36 cookies, and they were pretty good. At first I would have told you I wouldn't have made them again, but after the fact I thought they were really good and worth a try, and anything with honey in it I'm a sucker for. It could be noted in the cookbook that there were a couple of variants. You could stir a cup of bran cereal into the batter to make them honey bran cookies. You could sprinkle cinnamon sugar over top to give them a cinnamony flavor. And you could even stir in a cup of shredded coconut into the batter to make them honey coconut cookies. So apparently they're rather versatile. As you might have gathered, I shot a little video of this. So I'll put the couple minutes of how it went and what the cookies look like up on our YouTube channel. I might as well give that channel out, youtube.com/NWNJPA. You could go take a look at what they were. Unfortunately, you can't taste them, but you could see how the whole process went. Roundtable number 5, I have a couple of listener emails to get to. The first one is called Bee Sauna. Listener Nick Jordan shared a link to a website campaigning for a new weapon against the battle of the Varroa mite. The website has a description of the approach and a video showing the equipment involved. The premise of this solution is that it works on the concept that one can use controlled temperatures to heat a hive for a period of time. The solution emphasizes that the temperature, if kept greater than 102 degrees Fahrenheit, that's 39 degrees Celsius, can do irreparable damage to Varroa mite proteins, but it will not harm honeybees if kept below 113 degrees Fahrenheit, 45 degrees Celsius. The inventor shows a box that you put under a hive, and it looks like you plug it in, and it generates heat and administers a defined temperature. I say looks like because the information is overseas, and the preview video on the website appears to be in German. The suggestion is that you would heat your hive twice a year to perform the treatments. And I'm familiar with this concept. I seem to recall a different scientist, I believe it might have been Zachary Wong, doing this by heating a frame. I'm pretty sure I've spoken of this on a past episode, but the premise of this one is it heats the whole hive from the bottom. I'll provide some links to the site with the video, the homepage of the product, and the funding page, but be forewarned, they're all in German. It looks like a novel concept, but appears that that's what it is right now, a concept. They seem to be doing a Kickstarter-like campaign and have forecasts on what one of these might cost. From what I gather, they need around $140,000 to start manufacturing these, and it appears that they have pledges for half the capital so far. Thanks, as always, to Nick Jordan for providing the link. Roundtable number 6, this one's on wax cleanup, received a message from James Feeney. Thanks, James, for writing in. A couple thoughts on some episodes that we had, in one in particular, cleaning wax for processing. He shared a tip and a website for Mother Earth News, who had a page on how to clean wax. And it has an idea that I've heard before, and this is a great suggestion. Take your wax cappings, put them in a box, and put them on top of your hive and let the bees clean them. They will do a scrupulous job. He's referring back to episode 50, one of the segments, I think it was segment number 2, where we talked to Charlie Ilsley about how to process wax and one of the ways to clean honey out of wax cappings so that you can get it pure for candles and cosmetics. Appreciate the share, James. That's a great looking website. We're going to take a look over there and see what other things they have to offer. One of the questions you had was whether or not I built any swarm traps. Actually, that's what I'm in the process of doing. I'm following the tip from Jason Bruns. And Jason, he probably thinks I don't care for him much. That's not the case. I think I've shared this before in the podcast. I'm a little antisocial sometimes. I just have so much going on, and I make notes to get back and do things. But unfortunately, I'm constantly working on the next new thing. I know another person like that, it seems to be, is Randy Oliver. When I talk to him, he has the same kind of behavior. He's always working on something, and it's very difficult to go back and do your follow-ups. But Jason, let it be known that I read your stuff. I appreciate the share. Please keep sharing, and I'm heading to Swarm Trapville. That's why I pulled all that old wood out. I finally had time over the break to put it together, as I mentioned earlier in the episode, and I'll have spare boxes around to put up for swarm traps. I'm still on that objective for 2015. So again, thanks, James Feeney, for writing in. Appreciate you sharing that, and good luck in your endeavors there. Roundtable number 7, this one's called Baffled Beetles. This one comes by way of Neil Sexton from Willow Springs, Illinois. he shared a link to a video and a web page that is for a product called Beetle Baffle. It's a product in development for the war on hive beetles. I must admit, it took me a while to figure out what this thing is. After looking around the website, I think I've gathered enough facts to give a description of it. It appears that you affix these metal strips to the top edges of your bottom board and the leading edge of your first hive body over the bottom board. Another way to say that last part is the bottom front edge of the box that sits over the bottom board opening. So you have a metal strip across the three tops of your bottom board, and you flip your first box over and affix the strip to the bottom edge. These metal strips appear to protrude out and create a barrier where the beetles cannot walk straight up the sides of the hive body to the top of the hive where they tend to hang out. So picture a hive beetle coming into a hive. It's going to walk over to the edge of the bottom board and then walk up the side of the hive and go in. Once it encounters this barrier, it can't go out and over it, so it's stuck underneath and the bees can corral them there. As another part of this solution, it showed that you could drill a hole in the back of your bottom board, and they suggested affixing a soda bottle with some oil in it, if I got that right, and the beetles will walk around the bottom edge of the board looking for a way up, see the hole, go in, to never return. It's kind of a clever system, pretty simple, and it keeps the beetles from even getting in. On the website, I watched a video of this solution where he was talking about the number of beetles inside of a hive, and he was literally showing beetles all over the ground. It looked pretty cool. The website itself is, or the video itself was rather amusing, as he got stung somewhere in the middle and had to put on a veil, and you'll see if you go watch it. It's a little less sophisticated, but good for them on capitalizing on the innovation. And if you have a hive beetle program or problem where you are, you might want to take a look. And again, we really appreciate when listeners take the time to tip us off to this type of stuff. So thanks, Neil, for sending that along. And of course, we'll provide a link in our show notes. For roundtable number 8, wanted to give a shout out and a thank you to Dan Dodge for writing in. He wanted to know if we could provide some content on the top bar hive and some videos on the design and working of the hive. I think one of the key objectives in 2015 is to get that top bar hive functioning properly. You heard me say in the local hive report, I just can't seem to get it up and going. Been having conversations with Bob Kloss. I'm actually going to build another one. I have the parts and pieces out in the garage. This one will probably be a little more simpler than the current one. And as you know from the last episode where I was talking about, or one of the episodes I was talking about golden mean, I'm kind of contracting on that idea because maybe what I'm thinking is I want to have the pattern of the shape of the V in the trough to be the same as the one I have deployed. And therefore, I can exchange frames between the two. So anyway, I'm kind of thinking through that. Maybe if I measured that one, which I just did by serendipity, it's the golden mean. We'll have to look. So, Dan, I agree with you. I want to get through some of this top bar hive, become a little more familiar with that. A tip for listeners looking for top bar information. It seems that Phil Chandler has just released the latest version of his book. You could buy the hardcover book from his website, and you could also buy a PDF version for, I think it's like $5 US. So I'm going to pick that up. I don't have any experience with top bar hives. I've been reading what's readily available, but I know that Phil is a very trusted resource in this, and I'm very curious to see what he has to say. So biobees.com is where you can find a link to that, I'm sure. So I guess I'm looking at things and saying, oh my, where has the time gone? I guess I should get to closing comments, given how long we're going. I have a couple things to throw in the pile here before we say goodbye. There was a notion over the holidays that we would switch over our website. Unfortunately, that has become more difficult than conceived, as the technical hurdles to getting there have kind of set me back or put me behind schedule. I'm close, but there's a couple things I need to resolve. One on my punch list is making sure that the database that works in the background for WordPress is backed up, as I know if it becomes corrupt, the whole site just basically is gone and irretrievable, and I don't particularly want to suffer that fate somewhere down the road. So if you were looking for the new website in the beginning of the year, so was I, but we'll get there. Another note is I have been tied up over the holidays working on a new design for the Northwest New Jersey Beekeepers Association, which I am the webmaster. I'm looking to modernize that design, make it responsive design so it works well on phones and tablets, and add some new features and things like that. And that one, which is built from scratch, has become a lot of labor of love there. So that calls to reason why some of you who've written in over the breaks haven't heard from me. My spam problem for my email address is back, and I've been culling through that this weekend. Many of you have started to see responses from me. Don't be dismayed. Sorry. Just been distracted and heads down on other things. For example, Steve Bucknacki, I know you're waiting for a response from me. I'll get you this weekend sometime, probably. It comes to my mind that I never gave information about our website and how to write me. Our website is bkcorner.org. My email address is kevin@bkcorner.org. You can write me an email. Tell me who you are, where you're from, how to pronounce your name if you're sharing something with me so I get it right. And let me know if you're sending things along, whether you're okay with me sharing your pictures or whatever, if that's what you're doing. You can follow us between episodes, facebook.com/beekeeperscorner. I post things over there. And, of course, the YouTube channel that I manage jointly, I'll say, between the podcast and the Northwest Association. I'm consistently posting videos over there. Just posted, actually, the video on how to make the cookies I spoke about earlier. I shot that, and I'll be posting something on our frame jig later this weekend. It's youtube.com/nwnjba. So I know at times I tend to be a little off kilter. I've been a lot in this message, in this episode, and get a little corny, but I guess a true podcast has made it if you have a sign-off phraseology. I never had one. I just kind of make it up and do whatever whim, but I found something that I really liked, so let me close out the episode that way, and from now on, if it works, we'll go this route. Thanks, everybody, for listening. We'll catch you next time. So, like our beloved bees, when beekeepers go together, we accomplish great things. Thanks for listening, and be well.